Welcome to Excess Returns, where we focus on what works over the long term in the markets. Join us as we talk about the strategies and tactics that can help you become a better long-term investor.
Justin Carboneau and Jack Forehand are principals at Validia Capital Management. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Validia Capital. No information on this podcast should be construed as investment advice. Securities discussed in the podcast may be holdings of clients of Validia Capital.
Hey guys, this is Justin. In this episode of Excess Returns, Jack and I talk with Eric Crittenden of Standpoint Asset Management about their all-weather systematic approach to investing. We talk to Eric about the use of trend following, the importance of diversification and multi-asset classes, and much more. And make sure you stick around to hear Eric's blind taste or return test study and why Dennis Rodman was perhaps one of the best values in terms of NBA players ever. I think you'll find both of those things very interesting. As always, thank you for listening. Please enjoy this discussion with Standpoint's Eric Crittenden. Eric, thank you very much for coming back on with us second time around on Excess Returns. We appreciate it.
You bet. Thanks for having me on, guys.
So we wanted to, and I think it's been, maybe we were talking like over 2 years since we last had you on. And so it's always good to check in and get your thoughts on a bunch of different things. We wanted to talk to you more about all-weather investing and what makes for a good all-weather strategy, how you kind of are thinking about international assets and investing, and you know, overall views on portfolio construction and how you and your team think about sort of macro, systematic macro trend following and investing, which kind of sits at the heart of what you guys do over there. But maybe to start, let's kind of start at a high level. Like when you think about or explain all-weather investing, how do you sort of explain it and define it? And then what, in your opinion, are good characteristics of an all-weather strategy?
Yeah, so great topics. All-weather to me is simply being prepared for what we know is plausible. So my research typically goes back to at least 1970. I try to go back further than that, but the data gets somewhat sparse. But definitely there's good data from 1970 forward. Mm-hmm. And I feel like a lot of investors are essentially blind to what went on from 1970 to 1982. You know, rising interest rates, inflation, some would argue stagflation, and what they can do to a portfolio. So a good all-weather program is, in my opinion, is something that's going to fill in those potholes and have assets and or strategies that can help a portfolio maintain a reasonable compounded growth rate through really difficult periods of time. And there's different ways to have difficult times. Yeah, there's bear markets, there's stagflationary environments, deflationary environments, general stagnation. Last year, 2022, was a good example of what can happen, where you have, you know, bonds going down at the same time that the stocks are going down. So having something in the portfolio that can thrive during periods like that and having it in there in size so it really makes a difference is kind of the minimum requirement for having a good all-weather portfolio.
Speaking of blind, you have this YouTube video up where you do, it's the title of it is Blind Taste Test, but I guess it could be called Blind Return Test. And it's a really interesting video. And I think it, you know, it speaks to how sort of investors kind of make decisions. And when they're presented with, you know, figures, how some of their decisions might be different, than what they actually do in real life. So I don't know. I thought you'd like to kind of explain what you did in that video. I think it's cool.
Yeah. So I started out in the hedge fund world, and I dealt with primarily, you know, individual investors. And here in Arizona, real estate is popular, stocks are popular, and global macro strategies are not particularly popular. So I faced an uphill battle of convincing people to adopt kind of an all-weather mentality for the whole portfolio. So I had this idea of anonymizing asset classes and then showing people these asset classes. So I would have a spreadsheet. Sometimes I would do it on an overhead, you know, whiteboard. And you would have these, you know, annual returns in columns for 5, 6, sometimes 8 different asset classes, things like stocks and gold and global macro and bonds and corporate bonds and MLPs, thing, you know, different asset classes. But I would anonymize them so they didn't know which asset class is which. They were just color-coded, red, orange, green, blue, so on and so forth. And down at the bottom, they could see the annualized returns, the annualized volatility, the worst decline, the max drawdown, and then the average correlation with the other asset classes. And I would say, hey, let's build a portfolio together. You pick your favorite one, and that'll be, say, 40% of the portfolio. and then pick your second favorite one, and that'll be 25%, and then 15, and so on and so forth. And so they would build a portfolio, and it was remarkable that in virtually all cases, they would build a really durable all-weather portfolio. And then I would do this, the fun part, which is reveal the asset classes. And they would notice that the portfolio they built was essentially the opposite of what they did in real life. You know, they would have global macro typically in first place, followed by T-bills and some gold, maybe some MLPs, and then usually stocks represented by the S&P 500 would be in last place. And that's the exact opposite of what they do in real life. So did it work? Sort of. I mean, it was convincing because they could see the data and they could see this nice equity curve of this all-weather strategy or portfolio that they built. Did they stick with it in real life? No, which is very interesting. They would try it, a few of them, but they couldn't stick with it. You know, within a year, they were right back to overweighting stocks, having a very small allocation and true diversifiers, and basically ignoring everything else except for a little bit of bonds in there.
I'm curious, why do you think it is that, you know, despite those return numbers, that everybody wants to invest in stocks and bonds? I mean, is it the machine of Wall Street, you know, just wants to sell stocks and bonds? Because, you know, what's interesting is if you take a look back and look at these portfolios, these all-weather type portfolios, I mean, they really do have better risk and return characteristics than just a stock and bond portfolio. And, you know, we're seeing some of that now. But why do you think it is that everybody just wants to invest in stocks and bonds?
It's because envy drives the markets. It drives investor psychology, I think. That's the way I see it. So, and what you said, that a good all-weather kind of multi-asset portfolio has competitive returns over the long term, that's a true statement, in my opinion. But does it have competitive returns at the precise moment that people are staring at their accounts and making emotional decisions? No. The all-weather portfolio will underperform during a recovery. But you'd like to think it doesn't matter because a good all-weather portfolio didn't go down very much prior to the recovery, you know, during the crisis or during the disaster when risk portfolios are down 30 or 40 or 50 or maybe even 60%. A good all-weather program might be down 20 or 15 or 18 or something like that. So you don't need to make the really high returns on the other side of the chasm. But that's the moment in time that people are paying the most attention to their portfolios, staring at those year-to-date returns. And it just so happens, and I'm not sure why, that's when emotional decisions get made. So in practice, the all-weather portfolio makes sense, but you don't get to jump to the end and just hold it for 10 years or 20 or 30 years. You got to survive the path traveled along the way. And a lot of people can stick with an all-weather portfolio and prefer it, I think. But when you show them the individual components and they see the diversifiers sometimes being flat when the stock market's up for the year, or heaven forbid being down a little bit, they feel like they're getting left behind. They make that emotional decision to abandon true diversification and go back to pure growth investing, usually at the worst possible time.
This is the challenge, you know, we face with the kind of portfolio, we run some portfolios like this too. And this idea of line item risk is a huge issue. You know, it's like your portfolio as a package has actually done a pretty good job, but now I'm going to dig in there and I'm going to look at each individual component and I decide, well, that one component's not working right now, so I got to get rid of that. And you know, that's a challenge with investors because they don't want to just look at the whole package. They want to pick apart those individual items.
Yeah, in fact, there's another experiment that I used to do where I would show people aggregate results of a portfolio. I even did it in different contexts, like real life rather than just financial assets, like assembling a team. Maybe working at a corporation or a sports team or whatever. And they would look at the aggregate results and say, that's fantastic. I'm really on board. And then on a different day, show them the same thing, but don't tell them it's the same thing, but show them all the intricacies inside. And they start picking apart all the things that look like problems, anything that's down this quarter, you know, anything that's underperforming, you know, and then they want to abandon all the diversification and ram it all into the best performing assets. Which we know is a really bad idea long term. They can't help themselves. So in one context, you know, their response is, this is great, keep doing what you're doing. In a different context, the same thing. It's the exact same thing. But you gave them transparency into each line item, and now all of a sudden they see problems where there really are none.
You mentioned this idea before about all-weather portfolios are good about dealing with what's plausible. And I'm wondering, like, that's something we struggle with as well, is this idea of, you know, when you see something for 30 years that doesn't happen, but it is plausible, it's hard to, you know, explain it to investors. Now, it's easier to explain it now because now we're seeing it. But, I mean, do you have any things you've kind of done around that that would help to, you know, have investors see the wide range of things that could happen, even if they haven't happened in a long while?
So let's put this in context. I think what you're referring to is for 40 years now, up until 2022, stocks and bonds have had a negative or at least non-correlation. And bonds have been a great diversifier to stocks. And for a long time, they actually were a great hedge. And you got paid to hedge, meaning the 10-year treasury, I think, yielded 7% annualized for 40 years and like a negative 30% correlation with the S&P 500. So it was just a unicorn situation where stocks and bonds were the ultimate marriage. So how do you convince people that that's not always how it is and that that 30 or 40-year period that they're looking at was actually the anomaly? Because it's hardwired into the system. I mean, all of Wall Street, all financial advisory basically is relying on this assumption that stocks and bonds are the ultimate marriage and that bonds belong in the portfolio at any level of interest rates, any level of debt, you know, any level of unfunded liabilities. Well, there's an easy way to do it. You just go back to the 1970s and show them from 1968 to 1982, which is a 14-year period, you had an absolute nightmare ride for a 60-40 portfolio. Stocks and bonds were positively correlated. They had huge drawdowns. Real returns were negative. If baby boomers get a 14-year run like that starting last year, that's not going to be a good experience. And I'm willing to almost promise you nobody will be singing the praises of a 60-40 portfolio if you get that environment again. So that's one answer, is you can simply show them that outside of this 35-40-year window you're looking at, these assumptions don't hold up. And you can go back further in time and see that over really long periods of time, the expectation is that stocks and bonds are positively correlated, not negatively correlated. So, and if we get that, and we saw the first hint of it in 2022, if you get a decade of that, people are going to feel very differently.
Yeah, on that point of correlation, you know, one of the things that there's been a learning experience for me, and I think a lot of investors don't totally understand, is this idea that, you know, if you've got your stocks and bonds and you've got kind of your long-term return of each one of them, if you've got, say, a third asset you want to add to that portfolio, and let's say that third asset has a lower long-term return or expected return than stocks and bonds, but that asset is uncorrelated with stocks and bonds, you actually can increase the overall return of your portfolio. Could you just talk about that a little bit? Because I think that's something a lot of people miss.
Yeah, good luck. That one's tough, man. It's really difficult because it doesn't make intuitive sense to people. So I've tried, and you given enough time and some illustrations, you can demonstrate that. So when I try to relate it back to the real world, I have two kind of metaphors that I use. One is basketball. So I don't know if you guys are old enough to remember Dennis Rodman.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Sure.
Yeah.
Pistons.
Yeah. So Dennis Rodman's statistics were not very good. You know, he was not, he was a good rebounder, but statistically speaking, he was not a breakout player that, you know, you'd want to sign to a big contract. However, nobody in the history of the NBA added more value to a team indirectly by making all the other players around him better. So he was an ingredient that when added into the team yielded championships, it yielded playoff appearances for a reasonable cost. And it's because he just was this weird glue, this magic ingredient that when added in made everyone else on the team, you know, 1, 2, 3 standard deviations better at their own game. And he never got credit for that. And there's a couple other people, my peers in the industry, that have pointed this out, that's a good metaphor. So I did not come up with that. I'm stealing that from them. So I want to give credit to them. I wish I could remember their names. But that's one way. And, people can relate to that and say, yeah, I'm a Royals fan, or, you know, I'm a Raiders fan or whatever. And when they added in a couple of people that I wasn't excited about at first, the whole team got better. You know, whether it's special teams people or alignment, unsung heroes is what I call them. Another metaphor would be from chemistry, right? Where you have this ingredient that on the standalone basis doesn't seem like it's particularly desirable, but when you add it into the compound, and now the compound becomes something that's useful. So I like to tell the story that when you're walking through the desert and you find someone who's dying of dehydration, they don't need hydrogen and they don't need oxygen. They need those two things mixed together, and that's the solution. So hydrogen's useless to them. Oxygen is, they've already got enough oxygen. You mix it together in the right proportions and you've got a solution to their problems. I don't know if that helps, but that's
where. Yeah, no, those are actually two good ways to, your way was much better of explaining it than my way was of explaining it. How do you think, you know, On this idea of sort of the 60/40 versus all weather products, you know, we're seeing a lot more, you know, you've had yours out for a while now, but we're seeing more, especially in the ETF space, like these types of products coming out. And do you think that's going to help in terms of, you know, people now understanding what these products are and potentially considering like putting them in a portfolio versus like a 60/40 now that they're more available to the average investor?
Absolutely. I mean, results matter, right? So you know, we've been around, we're coming up on 4 years now. People are looking at it and saying, well, yeah, and that makes sense to me. You know, they look at what we did during COVID and then the recovery and then last year. So they at least can get a feel for what we're talking about. So being able to demonstrate value, people can look at it and objectively, you know, figure out whether it actually adds value to their portfolio or not. So I welcome the products into the marketplace. You know, I'm not afraid of competition because the all-weather category doesn't exist yet. So we need to create it. So we need more products so that people can actually have things to choose from and minimize their manager risk and whatnot. So I hope more people launch more products similar to ours.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's kind of a win-win right now, because all you guys that are educating people on all-weather strategies, you're benefiting each other by taking this thing that wasn't on investors' radar and, you know, putting it on investors' radar. So everybody kind of wins in that situation.
For now, yeah. So we'll be at each other's throats 5 years from now.
Eventually, right.
For
that
now.
That always happens on Wall Street, I guess, to some degree.
I'm in the desert. We're not Wall Street here, so.
I'm just wondering, benchmark-wise, do you have any tricks in terms of having people not compare these things to, like, the 60/40 portfolio or the S&P 500? You know, that's one of the things. I mean, those are kind of arbitrary benchmarks, but it's something that everybody sees on CNBC every day and everybody's kind of using, you know, to compare these things when these things are really geared to do sort of a very different thing than what those types of portfolios do. So do you have any tricks in terms of how you think about how people should benchmark these strategies?
Not really. You know, it's just be honest with people and do business with the people that don't want to just invest everything in stocks, really. I mean, the S&P is essentially free. I think you can get it for 3 or 2 basis points now in various different formats. So I view that as not a competitor at this point. So, but there's a healthy segment of the marketplace that wants something that looks and feels like an absolute return, multi-asset, all-weather approach. And my advice would be just find those people. I mean, they've got more money to invest than you and I could ever manage. And we're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars, and it's still, you know, a drop in the bucket relative to the whole marketplace. And let the performance chasing stock people just go ahead and continue to do that. I mean, educate as much as you want, but if it doesn't resonate with them and it's not what they want, you can't force it.
Yeah, one of the things I think you've done that's unique, and you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but this whole idea of, you know, if people are going to judge you against stocks and bonds, you know, you can give them a portion of stocks and bonds in their portfolio, and then you could take something like managed futures that looks really different, and you can kind of add it on top of that. So that behaviorally, that's a better package maybe than just managed futures for somebody. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, that's essentially what we're talking about, right? That blind taste test was my way of giving people access to different asset classes and forcing them to be objective, so that and then showing them that what they end up building is very similar to what we're offering, which is an all-weather product, but all rolled into one program with capital efficiencies, all managed internally. So you don't have to deal with the line item risk. You don't have to deal with the rebalancing. You don't have to deal with the tactical aspects of it. So yeah, behaviorally, it makes a big difference. That's what we were talking about earlier, where it's like, well, people like the solution, but then if you crack it open and show them all the line items, they lose their minds. So rolling it all up into one all-weather program is a way to insulate them from that.
On the managed futures side, I'm just curious. There's been a lot of debate going on like podcasts and stuff recently in terms of how do you construct one of these strategies? Because there are so many assets out there you can invest in. And, you know, some people think, you know, just get the big muscle movements, just get the major stuff, and you've pretty much, you know, done what you need to do. And then other people build really, really wide, diversified portfolios across a lot of stuff. So how do you think about that?
Well, I'll use a sports analogy again. There's different ways to make the playoffs and win a Super Bowl. You know, there's the West Coast offense, and then there's the old NFC East style. They can both work. So neither side is wrong. I mean, they may have some minor assumptions that might be frivolous in some cases, but either way can work. I'm stuck right there in the middle. You know, I'm not trading 300 different markets. Like some CTAs or managed futures guys want to do, but I'm also not distilling it down to four components the way some of the replicators do. there's a cost and a benefit to both approaches, but a happy medium in the middle gets you, 90% of the diversification at, say 30% of the operational headache is the way to go. Our philosophy at Standpoint is to go for scale. So we want to participate in, at least 80% of the liquid, what we call risk transfer markets. And those are going to be futures markets or forward markets. So things like metals and grains and energy and bond futures, currencies, soft commodities, so on and so forth. And we want a good, representative, healthy sample of the global risk transfer markets. And you can get that pretty easily with just sticking with futures markets. Do we then need to go out and create synthetic markets through spreads and start trading obscure markets like, Japanese platinum or South African maize? You can do that, but they're not big enough to make a meaningful difference. Because of the way we run our program is it's everything is liquidity weighted. These smaller, tiny markets, I could add them in, but they don't even produce a rounding error in the overall performance. So other people want to trade them. Hey, my hat's off to them. If you don't want to trade them, it just doesn't make much of a difference.
Yeah, it kind of, it made me think about what we do in factor investing when you were answering that, because a lot of people get trapped in the same thing, which is like little minor factor tweaks and stuff. Everybody gets wrapped up in that. And you miss the big picture of, most of these things are doing pretty much the same thing, whether they're tweaking it here and there. Like you've got to get the big picture and, get into the strategy, I would assume, with managed futures. The biggest thing is, being in managed futures and not necessarily, picking and choosing every little minor thing.
Yeah, the big trends are where the money's at. During COVID, it was short energy. After the recovery, it was being long risk assets. In 2022, it was being short every bond on the planet. Are there some ancillary trends around that also worked? Sure. But is the scale there? No. So the key is when the big trends happen, you got to be on the right side of those. And they're going to be in the deep liquid markets if you want something that's scalable. So I understand your point. In factor investing, there's three, four, maybe five factors that account for 90% of all the alpha potential. Focus on those and at least get the blocking and tackling right on those before you worry about the small stuff.
One of the things that I noticed about your portfolio that's unique is a lot of people I've seen who run these strategies tend to be U.S. centric, and you have some exposure in the international space. And that's been sort of a big debate recently in just overall in markets, is because international markets have struggled a lot. A lot of people don't have any international exposure and have gotten away from it. So I wonder if you just talk about what you do from the perspective of using international assets in the portfolio and what your thoughts are in general on using international assets and international diversification.
Oh. Having been born in the U.S. and lived here my whole life, it's really easy to default to the home country bias. If you're going to default to home country bias, it's safest to do it in, the United States of America. That being said, I'm a data guy, so I look at the data. And the last I checked, global GDP, only about 24% of it comes from the U.S. So there's a lot of stuff going on in the rest of the world. And my answer to that is, why not? Why not incorporate trends and risk premia from Europe and Asia and other places if it's accretive to the portfolio? And I find it to be very accretive. I mean, there's some markets that we trade over in Europe, like carbon emission credits, huge, deeply liquid market, the trends beautifully, highly profitable. And then you look most macro guys in the U.S. never even heard of it and don't have it in their portfolio. So there are opportunities overseas. As long as they're not harming the portfolio, I see no reason to exclude them. They're a little more cumbersome to trade because you have to do currency conversions. But I mean, we set that up a long time ago. I've been trading that way for 15 years. So it's not a lot more work to include all that extra liquidity, all those extra risk premiums that are overseas.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like the way like trend followers like you look at this and the way we look at it is so different. But we're getting to the same place. Like we look at it from the perspective of, emerging markets are cheap or something, so I should invest in them. You guys tend to look at it from the perspective, is it a diversifying asset? Does it trend? And if it's a diversifying asset and it trends, for you, it makes sense. You're not worried about the long-term expected returns or anything like that because you're going to be long and short and in and out. And it's just interesting, the different perspectives on it.
Yeah, that's fair. We're participating in the risk transfer markets. What you're talking about are the capital formation markets, like stocks and bonds overseas, and where valuation and certain factors matter a lot. And it is an important question you're asking, because there are times where foreign markets dramatically outperform U.S. markets, and that can drag on for more than a decade. Who knows? We might be entering a period of time like that. Maybe not, but I can tell you that relationship between U.S. outperforming ex-US outperforming. It's pretty cyclical, and the US has been outperforming by a large margin for a long time. So it won't surprise me at all if it reverts back like it always has in the past going forward.
One of the interesting things, you know, investors are typically pretty familiar with stocks and bonds and commodities and the types of things that are in trend following strategies, but currencies is one that you won't see your average investor trading, but you guys do. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about what the benefits are of having a currency, you know, currencies inside of a strategy like this.
Yeah, they're just another liquid asset for us where we go to try to collect a risk premium. I mean, if you look at a currency, you know, cross rate, it's really just a hybrid fixed income trade. In my opinion, or at least that's the majority of it. It's that country's risk-free rate versus your country's risk-free rate. So it's kind of a hybrid fixed income spread trade. I find them to be great diversifiers. They oftentimes will have big moves that are unrelated, or at least they're somewhat unrelated to what's going on in the macro view of your own portfolio of stocks and bonds, at least on a delayed basis. I mean, there've been times where the yen is just an amazing trending vehicle and you could pick up risk premium there. The euro has been a great trending vehicle for years now. You know, the British pound, the Australian dollar, the Kiwi, there's just a lot to choose from and you can get a lot of valuable diversification if you know how to invest in those things. Why other people don't? I think the macro guys do. I mean, currencies are a big portion of most macro managed futures portfolios. Your average investors, retail investors and financial advisors just don't see them as assets to own. They're just, from their perspective, they're just currencies. And that's the difference between a risk transfer market and a capital formation market.
Can you talk a little bit about portfolio construction? You know, you pick, obviously the first step is we want to pick the assets you want to have is to potentially include in your portfolio. But then you've got the idea of how do I construct a portfolio? How do I weight these assets? Things like that. Can you just talk about how that works?
Yeah. So, when I was younger, that's primarily where I spent most of my research time, was trying to figure out the most intelligent ways to construct portfolios to reward non-correlated markets and take away from highly correlated markets. I've done, seems like thousands of it. My eyes have bled from the amount of research I've spent on portfolio construction. And what I've found over the years is that it's a little overblown. What you need to do, again, get the blocking and tackling right. And that first step is go find diversifying assets that are liquid and scalable and bring them into your portfolio. So get foreign bonds, you know, get aluminum and copper and nickel and get energy markets and get foreign currency markets. Just go out there and find the big liquid markets that are statistically different from what's in your portfolio and pull them in. Once you've got them in, if you want to scale, like we do at Standpoint, you know, you have to weight them according to their liquidity. You know, you can't trade the New Zealand dollar with the same kind of size that you can trade the euro. You know, one's 30 times the size of the other one. So if you want to be able to maintain your strategy as you grow, you need to essentially market cap weight or open interest weight these positions. So get them in, weight them that way first, and then take a look at, is there anything else that you can do in your portfolio to spread the risk units around in a more intelligent way? What I find is just liquidity weighting a portfolio made up of the most liquid futures markets in the world, it gets you 80% the way there. It's almost always very balanced and diversified. And that's just because the economies, the way they move the risk units around and the open interest goes up and then it goes down, volume goes up, it goes down. You pretty much always end up with a balanced and diversified portfolio. Occasionally, you'll see correlation spike to an uncomfortable level and then you can intervene and say, you know what, that's everything's getting too unbalanced or imbalanced. So a lot of people will use a correlation overlay to limit, you know, how concentrated they're willing to get into really extreme trends. But 80, 90% of it is just getting those diversifying assets into the portfolio in the first place.
And how do you think about measuring trend? I mean, there's a lot of indicators you can use as all the different look back periods. I mean, do you think of like a composite type approach? Is that how you think about it?
I do. However, this one's a big deal. Short-term trend following can look very different from long-term trend following, and it often does. Medium-term trend following can be different than both of them. So that's why you see all this performance dispersion. You know, a lot of people say, oh, I hate managed futures because some managers are up 20 on the year, others are down 13. Like, I don't know which one to pick. It drives them crazy. most of that can be attributed to whether they're a short-term trend follower, medium-term, or long-term. It makes a big, big difference. So my bias is towards long-term trend following. You know, I have this thesis that in these risk transfer markets, we collect a premium from commercial hedgers, you know, because that's the service we're providing. They like to sell rising markets and buy falling markets. We do the opposite, giving them the liquidity to lock in input costs or to lock in output profit margins. That works a lot better in a medium or long-term context. However, I cannot deny that when you look at the data going back to 1970, short-term trend following works pretty damn good too. So, and it tends to work better when long-term is struggling. So it's important to diversify. So you're right, I built a composite where I mix short-term, medium-term, and long-term trend following all together in one portfolio to try to smooth it out and not try to pick which one's going to be the hero this cycle around. Case in point, I told you my bias is towards long-term trend following. Since Standpoint went live at the end of 2019, our short-term trend models have been far more profitable than the medium and long-term trend models. So I'm glad I had the fortitude to diversify and make sure I had all the bases covered.
I'm just curious, and this they may be unrelated, but people always talk about this idea that like the market is sped up. Does that have anything to do with the fact that the short-term ones are working better? Or are those kind of unrelated concepts?
Yeah, I don't think I agree with the concept that the market is sped up. It depends. You know, so many things in life depend upon the context. Because, you know, you might say, well, Eric, I've heard you say that since, you know, you launched the fund, we've had, you know, four market cycles. We had a bull market and we had a brutal, fastest bear market in history, and then the recovery, and then we had stagflation, and now who knows what we have now. That's true, but that's not speed. Speed to me is the speed of the trends and the speed of the reversals. Yeah, COVID was fast. That definitely was a sped up. But if you look at all the data, say you go back to, I don't know, 1995, and you look at all this data and think to yourself, wow, this is so crazy. Look how fast markets are. Go look at that same data in the 70s, and you'll see even more speed. You know, less liquidity, but even more speed. So have they sped up, or are we just getting something like the 1970s after a long period of low volatility meandering in the after 2010? I'm not sure. So it depends on your definition of sped up.
Can you talk a little bit about leverage? You know, when people hear the word leverage, they kind of freak out. They think like I'm adding tons of risk to my portfolio when I use leverage. But people who are in your space have used leverage forever and have used it in very, you know, efficient, smart ways. So can you just talk about how you think about leverage when building a portfolio?
Yeah. So leverage is basically a tool. And yeah, it's a word you don't want to throw around very often because it scares people, because they all have heard of somebody who leveraged up a single position or a single asset class, and then their 20% drawdown became an 80% drawdown. So, but and that you can do that, right? It's not very smart, but people do it. Companies are leveraged. You know, when you buy the stock market, you're buying companies that have leveraged balance sheets. Some of these financial companies have eye-popping amounts of leverage. In the context of a diversified kind of multi-asset portfolio, though, it can make sense to use a modest amount of leverage because a lot of the assets are too far from cash. You know, when you buy two-year treasuries or the German Schatz or, you know, one of the Australian three-year bond or whatever, that's not too far from cash. And it may trend nicely, but, you know, a $50 million position might not be big enough. You know, and with futures, it's super easy to get the leverage and you don't have to borrow to pay for the leverage. You know, it's just implied. It's inside the contract already. So a typical macro guy, 4 to 5x leverage is what I've seen over the years. Our program is not risk seeking like that. You know, we're more like 2 to 1 typically on the macro side. But it's not because we're taking a lot less risk. It's because we don't trade a lot of those close to cash vehicles like short term interest rates and whatnot, where you have to leverage them if you want to squeeze out a return. So now if you're leveraging Bitcoin, clearly you're crazy. If you're leveraging 2-year treasuries, well, that's something very different. So it's not enough to say leverage is bad. It's what are you levering? How much are you levering it? And in what context? Is it in the context of a diversified portfolio? Or are you leveraging some property out in the suburbs, you know, right before 2007 hits? Those are two very different things. So for us, yeah, we use a modest amount of leverage when it makes sense. but we still feel like that's considerably less risky than just use an unleveraged position, say in the S&P 500, where the underlying companies might be leveraged considerably more than we are.
I'm curious, I don't know if you've done any work around this, but one of the things that's interesting to me about these sort of all-weather type strategies is it seems like they would really be great for retirement portfolios, especially, you know, when you're dealing with sequence risk in retirement, when you're dealing with that big drawdown at the wrong time can really kill you. I would think these systems with more consistent returns would lead to higher sustainable withdrawal rates. And I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, in fact, I went down that road and tried to do a whole bunch of Monte Carlo simulations and show that to people. And they all agree. When they're just looking at the results, they all say, yeah, that makes total sense. I mean, the sequence risk is really reduced because an absolute return all-weather approach takes a lot less uncompensated cyclicality risk, which is what they're trying to get rid of, right? The boom-bust cycle, because the timing of those drawdowns matter. 2022 was very unfortunate for retirees. And if we get, you know, a couple more years like that, it's really going to screw up their retirement plans with no resolution to that, right? You have drawdowns now and it screws up the plan. That being said, in the retirement planning community, the bureaucracy is such that, you know, alternatives just really aren't considered. It's stocks, bonds, and T-bills. I think it's just going to take a lot of pain for them to be open-minded about doing something else, unfortunately. And that's just how bureaucracies work.
Just one more for me before I hand it back to Justin. I don't think you used these, but I'm just curious. You've been seeing, you know, especially with what happened in 2020, you've been seeing a rise of a lot more tail risk type strategies. You know, strategies that, you know, try not to lose money when, you know, during normal times, then have like ridiculous returns when you get like a 2020 drawdown. And I'm just wondering, do you think those types of things can make sense, like in an all weather type strategy, or, you know, have you not seen, you know, anything from them that would indicate that?
Yeah, I think it can make a lot of sense. They're a bit redundant. So a good trend oriented macro program is going to share a lot of the qualities of tail risk hedging at those inflection points where tail risk hedging is paying off. And the idea is to do it with less cost of carry or drag when tail risk hedging isn't paying off. Pure tail risk hedging, though, takes it a step further and says we basically want to guarantee something close to a guarantee that if you know what hits the fan, we're truly going to make outsized returns. And that can be worth it to a lot of people. That's another thing you kind of got to bury in the fund, right? Because a lot of line item risk basis, tail risk hedging is by far the hardest asset class to hold on to. I think CalPERS ditched theirs right before COVID, if I remember that correctly. So yeah, it can make sense, but I've looked at it and found it to be mostly redundant though with what we're already doing on the trend side, at least when it matters.
Yeah, I always use them as like just as an example of like when you talk about how with a lot of these undiversified assets, you have to rebalance to get the value out of them. You know, tail risk is like the extreme example of that, because, you know, if you go through 2020 and you get that return and you don't rebalance, you know, you're going to lose the entire benefit of having the strategy. So it's just a good example I use for investors to show an extreme example of rebalancing and how it plays a role with these uncorrelated assets.
Yeah. Some of my peers in the industry that I think are really smart, you know, the guys at Mutiny and Resolve and Newfound, have done a lot of research on that type of strategy. And I've looked at their research and concluded that, yeah, it looks correct to me. Tail risk hedging can add a lot of value. If that's what you're looking for, it can make a lot of sense. It's just hard to hold on to.
You've obviously done a lot of back testing and studying of different investment strategies over time. And you were on the, I think it was the Picture Perfect Portfolios podcast, where you were talking about back testing. And you kind of made the point that, you know, with back tests, you want to look for like robustness, but you don't want to, you know, add so many additional rules and criteria in, because it kind of can detract and actually hurt the strategy. Do you just want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So how often do you guys see ugly back tests?
Zero.
Yeah. Nobody ever shows you an ugly back test, right? Or an ugly resume. So back test like resume in a sense. A back test is a way of taking your rules today, going back in time and answering the question, how would this thing likely have performed historically? The problem is that you know what happened historically. So you have to insulate yourself from perfectly fitting it to what happened historically, which no one can really do. And then people will tune the parameters so that it works even better historically. And then they'll get carried away often, and they'll overtune the parameters and come up with new parameters to make it look even better historically. And what they're doing is they're fitting it perfectly to history, which will work great if the future is a perfect repetition of what we had historically. But oftentimes, usually completely fall apart if the future zigs and zags a little different than the past. We know that the future is going to zig and zag differently than what it did in the past. So there is a happy medium, though, where you can use historical data and you can create rules today to find out where the structural risk premia appear to have been, like what market conditions led to returns. And then you could ferret out these generalized rules of thumb. And then you can walk them forward on future data in real life. And if they continue to work, you can build a theory as to why they work. That's what I did with the trend following provides liquidity to commercial hedgers, therefore is entitled to a risk premium that they're paying for that insurance-like protection by shorting rising markets and buying falling markets. So how do you keep yourself from doing it? Well, there's a couple things that you need to do correctly when you're backtesting. One is make sure that what you're looking at actually looks like what history actually looked like. A lot of times when you buy data today, it's been cleaned and it's been perfected, but real life is dirty and messy, and you don't get the revisions until a month later or a quarter later or whatever. So you need to recreate history as it actually looked, because that's what you would have been trading on. So the convenient packaged data products and backtesting products generally won't do that for you. In fact, they do the opposite, and they think of it as a selling point to give you clean data after the fact. Well, that's like knowing the winning horses after the race is over. That's not a good start. The other thing is that you need to include all the dead markets. You know, if you try to pull up a chart today of Enron, you'll get an error and say it doesn't exist. I promise you, Enron existed. I was trading it along with Lehman and a whole bunch. You need to include delisted markets, because by kicking them out, you're creating an idealized version of history that didn't really exist. And you'll come up with rules that only work on an idealized version of history. And you're not going to get an idealized version of history going forward. And then there's a whole bunch of other errors, like post-dictive error, where people say, oh, if it crosses the 200-day moving average, I'm going to go long. If it falls below, I'm going to go short. But the bar that the day of it crossed, so it says, hey, you're long. But no, you're getting long the next day. You can't be long that day. You need to make sure that you're taking action after the signal. You'd be surprised how many people make that mistake. And then the curve fitting component is torturing that data until it gives you the answer you want is, I'm just going to say, it's always a mistake. And having realistic expectations, you know, something that says it's making 30% returns a year with 10% drawdowns is not real. You know, just look at the professionals. The most successful asset managers in the world can barely maintain a Sharpe ratio of one, you know, and very few people compound over 20% a year. Very few people have a Kalmar ratio better than one. So if your back test says you've got a Sharpe ratio of four and a Kalmar of two, I'm pretty sure you didn't figure out something that all the hundreds or thousands of PhDs in their supercomputers didn't figure out before you. So that's your first hint that you might be overfitting your back test.
Yeah, I think that idea you made, that you talked about, that you can't unknow what you know, is so important, because, you know, I know stocks and bonds had an incredible 40-year period. I know value investing has struggled over the last decade. Like, when you're constructing a back test, it's so hard to do it and like take that stuff out of your mind that you know actually happened.
So what I did, I went back to the 1970s. So include that nightmarish period of time. I also anonymized all my markets. So, and I did all kinds of stuff where I would denominate the markets in different currencies to change the path traveled. I created fake markets without me knowing, you know, which ones were which, and anonymized them so that when I was building the Standpoint macro system, I really reduced the likelihood that I would be picking and choosing markets based upon, you know, my knowledge of them after the fact. It's not a perfect solution, but it was a great step in the right direction. It actually showed me a few things that were my biases otherwise would have been contributing to the end results.
It seems to me like if you're an investor being presented with a back test, all those points you made are, I think, are excellent.
but would you also, and I would imagine anyone that's presenting you with a back test is going to be able to explain it, rationalize it, tell you, but I think like it would be very important that whoever did the back test or conducted the back test, their sound economic principles and theory behind why this strategy works or maybe didn't work in an environment. And if someone, I'm kind of asking you here, you know, if someone can't explain that to you, then that's probably a pretty big red flag, right?
I want to say yes, but no one ever does explain. I've been presented with hundreds of back tests over the years, and I can't recall anybody giving me a good economic rationale for why it should work. Yeah, I just can't. So, but yeah, that's what I'm looking for. Yeah, I'm looking for realistic expectations. Mm-hmm. You show me a Sharpe ratio of 4, I'm not buying it. I mean, I'll look at it, but it's just, you're the first one in the history of the world that's cranking out a 4. You know, a lot of these like factor strategies, you know, I just ask simple questions. Are the delisted stocks in there? 99% of the time, they're not. Do you have the delisted futures contracts? What'd you do pre-euro conversion? Do you have transaction costs that were, you know, 5 times higher in the 70s? No. So I send people back to the drawing board, and then they never come back. So I say, well, once they corrected for these issues, they saw it. They're like not making 30% returns anymore. They're making 12% returns with 12% vol and 15% drawdown. And then they're like, no, that's not good enough. But it is. It is. You mix it with risk assets and you roll it out as an all-weather program, it's more than good enough. But it's just, it's not exciting to them.
So that kind of plays into my next question, which is if you were an investor today and someone came to you with an all-weather strategy they were running and you weren't running your own, what would be like the major things that you would look at in that strategy?
Yeah, the first thing I would look at is what assets did they bring in? Did they bring in what I think of as true diversifiers? That's super important, right? Because a lot of these, I don't want to get into a fight with the all weather crowd, but you know, they primarily it's some form of risk parity, you know, stocks, leveraged bonds, maybe some commodities and whatnot. And that's okay. But it does have a big blind spot and that I think macro fills. And why does macro fill it? Well, because macro has access to metals and grains and soft commodities and energy and all these other things that can truly have big outsized moves that are uncorrelated with your risk assets. You're not just relying on negative correlation between stocks and bonds, and you're not relying on commodities to be an inflation hedge. Sometimes you can be short commodities when there's inflation. So I would look at their market selection first and foremost. And if they didn't have the true diversifiers in there, I would be much more skeptical going forward. And then the other principles we talked about, like how to construct it, is it scalable? A lot of people have these kind of small spread trading programs that work great with $50 million, but you try to put $500 million in there, they've got no chance. So they're not scalable. Yet if they're successful, people are going to throw money at them and then they have to change the program. I'm not a fan of that approach. You know, the realistic expectations is important to me. You know, if they believe they're going to get a Sharpe ratio of 3, my confidence in them is exponentially lower because I've never seen anyone do it, or at least explain to me why you deserve it. What is it that you're offering to the marketplace where the marketplace is going to reward you with a Sharpe ratio of 3? Sure, you can get with an arbitrage strategy. It's just that, you know, one day you're going to have a 50 or 80% drawdown out of the blue with not enough time for you to do anything about it. If you accept that, and you're aware of it, I can at least respect you. I don't want to invest in that myself personally, but I can respect it. But for the people that think they've got it figured out and that they're just going to have risk-adjusted returns that are off the charts and they don't know why, that's not good enough. Sorry.
Two more questions here. One is a little bit more, I think, short-term oriented or, I guess, topical for today's investor. And then the last one's going to be long-term and evergreen. But what would you say to an investor that says, you know what, I'm allocated to this type of strategy or maybe some other risk managed strategy today? You know, why don't I just throw in the towel and just buy treasuries and get my 5% yield and not have to worry about sort of any type of tracking error or performance? How would you answer that question?
Well, it depends on the investor. I think there's a segment of the population for which that's actually probably the right thing to do. But then I would ask them, you know, what are you going to be happy? Or what will happen if inflation's 8 and you've locked in 5.5. Are you okay with that? So for some people, they would say, yes, I'm okay with that. For my answer to that would be, it's your money, it's your life. If that's, if that suits your utility function, it's the right thing to do for your, for you financially, then go ahead. For people that view that as just, it's pure return, it's free returns. Well, it's not, you know, you need to inflation adjust, in my opinion, and fee adjust. If you're paying a financial advisor 100 basis points to put you in T-bills, well, you're giving up a fifth of your returns. You know, you're basically paying a 20% performance incentive. So inflation, transaction costs, fees, all the whole cost of carry, everything needs to be factored in, and then look at what you're left over with. And model that out going forward, and then look at your cost of living and model that out going forward. And if that's acceptable to you, sure, go for it. For most people, though, I think if they did an honest assessment of that, and taxes too, because you pay taxes before inflation if it's taxable money. So I'll share with you guys a story that might be a real big surprise to you. The 10-year treasury compounded at 7% a year up until COVID. For 50 years, I think it was 50 or 40 years. I can't remember, 7%. But for taxable money, you know, you're paying taxes on the yield there, and it's ordinary income rates. So that brought it down to like 4.5%. And then inflation was 3.6, I think. So that got it down to like 1%. If you're paying an advisor, 1%, I got it down to zero. And if you're paying any transaction, the real total net return after taxes and inflation was negative, even though the bond itself was compounding at 7% a year. So that's how much the cost to carry matters. And that applies to everything, including T-bills. So I would just ask people to be honest, put all that into a matrix and calculate it through and just see how much you're left over with in the end. It could be a real steep price you're paying for certainty and a less volatile path traveled.
In closing, we like to ask all of our guests sort of a standard closing question. And that is, if you could teach one lesson to your average investor, what would that be?
It's hard to pick one.
You can do two or three. Go for it.
Well, no, I want to pick one because I've never actually done that. I saw that and I didn't come up with an answer. I think that what would help people the most, more than anything else, is an appreciation for realistic expectations. And I know that falls on dead ears and it's not exciting, but let me try to make it exciting. If you have the data I have, if you could look at every hedge fund, every SMA, every variable annuity, ETF, mutual fund, CIT in the world that has ever existed, put all that into a massive database and you calculate up what are the Sharpe ratios, what are the annualized returns, Kalmar ratios, drawdowns, volatility, all that stuff, and you plot it, you will be shocked how humble the elite managers actually are in terms of what they've delivered. I meant what I said earlier, where, you know, a Sharpe ratio greater than one is very, very difficult to maintain for more than a decade. Very difficult. Elite managers Sharpe ratio of 0.6 is actually an elite number. So I find that very liberating because it keeps you corralled and away from chasing things that aren't real. So, and you can see it in the personality of our firm and in our products. You know, All Weather is really just saying, look, this is the best we can do. And it solves a problem for people. And it's pretty good if you actually hold it for the long term. We're not trying to win any awards. We're not trying to be famous. We just think this is the best way to have the highest compounded return at the end of the marathon, not trying to win the individual sprints along the way. And what allowed me to think that way is an honest view of reality. So I would say realistic expectations, while not exciting, liberates you from all the bad habits, or helps liberate you from the bad habits of chasing lures and things that just aren't real.
Eric, this has been a good, honest, straightforward discussion. You know, the word keeping things in context, I think, came up a lot throughout this talk. So, you know, we appreciate it. And thanks so much for coming back on.
Thanks, guys. It's always a pleasure. You ask great questions, and I'm glad I was able to tell you some of my fun stories.
This is Justin again. Thanks so much for tuning into this episode of Excess Returns. You can follow Jack on Twitter at @practicalquant and follow me on Twitter at @JJCarboneau. If you found this discussion interesting and valuable, please subscribe in either iTunes or on YouTube, or leave a review or a comment. We appreciate it.
Justin Carbonell and Jack Forehand are principals at Validia Capital Management. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Validia Capital. No information on this podcast should be construed as investment advice. Securities discussed in the podcast may be holdings of clients of Validia Capital.